The necessity of great doubt. If you're unable to raise great doubt when practicing Zen, even if you can dwell in an apparently calm and lucid state, sitting long periods in Zazen, sunk in quietness, even if within this mystic darkness, senses fuse and objects and opposition disappear, and even if you enter absorption without mind movement, this is not the great vehicle. This is simply your wavering mind. This is not Zen. If you don't recognize this error, innumerable Buddhas may appear and preach the Dharma, but they won't be able to save you. That's quite a sutra we have in our sutra book. Quite a strong caution against an error in terms of our orientation in practice. And the error is the notion that if I can quiet my mind, I will be saved. If I can exist like a piece of mold growing in a petri dish, I will be free from suffering. Thought will no longer plague me. I will be utterly free from the torment of my delusions. All I need to do then is quiet the mind. Amazing how pervasive this myth is in culture, that the point of meditation is to, for example, be with the breath and no longer have to think or feel anything at all. May as well be dead. Not what I consider the point of Zen. And I'm grateful for this caution. There's also within this orientation a subtler point that's here, which is that there is a kind of oneness that we can taste in our practice of Zazen. And you might say it's a side effect. It's a part of the a joyful side effect of practice can be the sense of kind of oneness and unity with our senses, the sensory world itself appearing as enlightenment. We even have a chant in our book here that says, this sensory world is enlightenment. So to kind of just awaken to this sensory world in the darkness, meaning the lack of thought, isn't often an orientation. They call this a kind of one-pointed concentration, a samadhi practice. Samadhi's not bad. Samadhi's, you know, nice when you have it. Sure, enjoy it. But to make it the point of practice is also quite a delusion. Because then you can't function in samadhi. You can't distinguish, weed from your food, poison from something nourishing. Samadhi is just this oneness, and you, once again, in a sense, may as well be dead. You can't do anything to be of benefit in the world. Again, not to say it's not without its pleasure, but it really, and it is always an aspect of our practice. We are always one with this sensory world, but we don't need to create that. And it really isn't the orientation of practice. It's not the goal. It's already true. So this raising of great doubt celebrated in this chant, and we have talked about this before, and I wanted to raise it again in the context of working with koans. So the first sentence of this, again, I'll read part of it. If you are unable to rouse great doubt when practicing Zen, even if you can do all these great things, this is not the great vehicle. It is not Zen. So great doubt, central to the practice of Zen. I want to share with you a reading from a separate little piece here. This is The Mirror of Zen. I've read from it before, a piece written by Zen master So San. He offers two teachings that I want to share. It is extremely important that Zen practitioners should pursue live words, not dead words. It is extremely important that Zen practitioners should pursue live words, not dead words. Commentary. When looking into your great doubt, when looking into your wado, your koan, there are two gates by which to enter, fiercely grabbing the key point of the koan, or merely grasping at the koan's conceptual meaning. Grabbing and holding fiercely the key point of the koan without letting go is practice with live words, which is a shortcut. It cuts the path of mind and the path of speech, allowing nothing whatsoever to hold on to. Merely pursuing the conceptual meaning of your koan is practicing complete and sudden enlightenment teachings through attachment to dead words. Such study only opens the wider the road to conceptual reasoning and the path of speech, since it is mainly concerned with thinking and conceptual understanding. So here, an encouragement to practice our koans as live words. Not to get lost in our conceptual answers. I'm reminded of the student who approached Zhao Zhao and said, "Teacher, does a dog have Buddha nature?" Now, the student may have been coming from many different places in asking this question. The student may have been asking, "Does even a dog like me have Buddha nature?" He may have been asking, "Does everything really have Buddha nature? Even the things..." Now, this is the story here comes from China, where the view at that time of dogs was not positive. "Does even something like a dog or a rat have Buddha nature?" Or as one student wrote to me one time years ago, "Even the decapitated head of a frog." And of course, the teaching is, yes, the conceptual teaching of Buddhism is, yes, all things are the Buddha nature. Everything, even our sadness, even our depression, our sense of loss, grief, everything, anger. And we sit and bear witness to these things, and they open up for us like flowers. And we see into their true nature, which is a kind of ephemeral dream in a way. Oh, there I go again. That's just a concept. We can't get lost in words. We can't get lost in the pointers toward the aliveness of the moment. The pointers are not it. Zhao Zhao, upon seeing him, probably thought, "Buddha nature? What the heck is that? I don't know what Buddha nature is, not as some kind of concept. Does this student even know what he's asking about? This student appears attached to a concept of Buddha nature. He hopes that he has it. He hopes that all things have it. He needs to be freed from any idea of Buddha nature to realize Buddha nature. Does a dog have Buddha nature?" Zhao Zhao responds, "No." Quite a shocking teaching, actually. "Everything has Buddha nature." Zhao Zhao says, "No. This is great doubt, cutting off the notion of Buddha nature." "Well, then what is the nature of everything if it's not Buddha nature?" "Precisely. Take a look. Don't trust your thinking about it. You should hold the koan with total determination. Like a hen nesting on her brood. I love that image. Like a cat hunting a mouse. Like a hungry man thinking of food. Like a thirsty man thinking of water. And like a child longing for its mother. Only if you practice with this kind of mind are you sure to penetrate your great doubt, your koan. I think of a hen sitting over all of its brood, its eggs, warming up these eggs with full patience and determination. Unwavering dedication. Patiently attending and waiting for the koan to open and reveal itself. Not done inside the hen's head. Not done through some conceptual realization, the eggs open. And all the hen does is sit and attend, bearing witness, caring for. All of these focused efforts come only from the deepest mind, are not artificial. It is a kind of intense sincerity. Without such deeply straightforward, striving mind, it is impossible to attain enlightenment. This question of great doubt, this issue of great doubt, is so important in our practice because we are so persistently deluded by our thoughts. We are so persistently led to believe notion after notion about ourselves, about the world, about Buddha nature, about philosophy. And the Dharma is saying, there is something more. I don't know about you, but senses of self for me are these kind of unending series of actors walking across a stage. In one moment, after I have done something about which I am particularly proud, I notice this sense of self arise that I am the man. I am the greatest drummer to have ever lived and breathed. And if only everybody knew it, because man, the way I played that last song was so frickin' good. Someone should have recorded. You know what? If someone had recorded that, I would be famous forever, right? And then, you know, the next song comes on, I start playing. I cannot find my way in. I literally cannot find the groove. It is not in me. I notice how loud my drums sound and out of proportion, and my fingers don't move, and I'm the worst drummer to have ever lived. I'm an embarrassment. Thank God no one is recording this. I just need to get through this. I'll just get through this moment of pain and agony. Why don't I sell this drum set? And it's amazing because these two things can happen within 5 minutes of each other, which is true. Well, of course, neither one. They're just senses of self. That's all. Just senses of self. And yet we go on believing and believing in these senses of self and in our senses of the world as if I don't even know myself, never mind anybody else. Do I really know what somebody else is? And yet, how often do I clap someone into a category that is absolute and fixed and most certainly true? Of course, we need our capacity to think in order to take action in the world. We are not trying to get rid of thought. We are not even trying to get rid of senses of ourselves. These arise, they're natural. They help us function, in fact. Without a sense of self, we could get into some real weird boundary issues with people. Very helpful to have a sense of self, but very important to also, as the bumper sticker says, not believe everything we think. Or as James Ford was fond of saying, don't believe anything you think. It's just a thought. I am this, I am that. The stories go on endlessly. We just witness them. We don't try to cut them off. We aren't trying to eliminate them so that we can just be one with the universe. We couldn't function that way. But we recognize that every thought is also quite limited, one-sided, quite profoundly deluded in some way, just not capturing the essence of anything, though they masquerade and pretend that they do. Our koans, practicing with koans. So in the Korean tradition, which is this second book that I'm reading from, is out of the Korean tradition. Well, actually, it originated in China, but it became hugely popular once translated in Korean and is a constant companion in monasteries throughout Korea. The koan that they practice with there the most is, who am I? Or what is this? And actually, these are not different questions. What is this turns toward ourselves? What is this sitting on this cushion? And I love that they're questions. Notice how we don't sit with, I'm the man, or I'm the worst, or there's no self at all. We sit with a question, the not knowing, most fundamental. For me, great doubt is another way of saying, I just don't know. I don't know with absolute certainty what kind of a drummer I am. I don't know with any kind of certainty. In other words, I don't know that there, I don't know the absolute and fixed nature of anything, because nothing has a fixed, absolute nature. Everything is always changing and becoming. And our job here is to notice that thoughts arise and thoughts go. And we don't know with certainty what is. We can't peg down with certainty what is, because it's changed by the time we've had that thought. So great doubt is a kind of way of relating with our thinking that just allows it to unfold without grasping, allows it to help us make decisions and take actions and do what we hope is most helpful without really knowing what is most helpful, with a kind of humility, constant awareness, attending, recalculating, recalibrating, letting go of our pride, letting go of our shame, letting everything unfold without grasping. The koans ask us to engage with these great questions that open us up. Who am I? What is this? What is Buddha nature? What is enlightenment? but to answer with our whole being, not just with our thinking, to answer with the fully embodied presence of our practice. And that's the key here. We don't have to cut off our thinking entirely. Just let it do its thing without attaching to it. And be present, physically present to the fullness of what is here. Attending, attending. Just this, just this. What is this? What is this? To allow the koan to be that as well. What is this Buddha nature?